And Governor Brown's Global Climate Action Summit, which is scheduled to kick off at the end of this week, has also proven a tremendous organizing opportunity for environmental justice organizations across the state and around the world to demand more climate action from the state of California than it has done to date. The campaign in the run-up to the summit, the Brown's Last Chance campaign, explicitly calling for the state of California to halt development of all new dirty fuel infrastructure in California and to create a plan to phase out all fossil fuels as quickly as possible while providing support and opportunities to people who would be impacted by job losses resulting from that transition. It raises a bigger question, which is how much can you get out of action at a state level? And why hasn't California done all of it yet? We thought we'd get into the details of the reasoning behind the asks and the organizing behind the protests. We're joined in studio with someone who's been central to both, Mia Yoshitani, Executive Director with the Asian Pacific Environmental Network. Thank you so much for coming in.
Good morning.
So first of all, the Brown administration really burnished its green credentials on a national stage. Jerry Brown has picked fights with the Trump administration, specifically on the issue of climate action. The tone and tenor of this week's protests, not particularly sanguine about where the state of California is. What are your biggest areas of concern?
In terms of what Jerry Brown is offering our state in terms of his climate leadership, some of our biggest concerns are, especially with this this elevation that Jerry Brown is getting, this microphone that Jerry Brown is getting right now on his climate leadership and the direction that he's taking California, is that we don't want California to be the pinnacle model for the rest of the country, the rest of the world. That's what Jerry Brown is saying. He's saying that the policies that we put into place, the hallmark one being cap and trade as the main vehicle through which the state will reduce carbon emissions from our biggest industrial polluters, that is the answer that everyone else should be looking to in order to reduce carbon and reduce climate emissions.
Explain why that's a problem.
That is a problem because it relies on, I'll try to do it as simply as possible.
Sure.
Basically, the cap is the thing that says you have to reduce your emissions, ratcheting them down year after year. That's the thing we like. We want a cap. We think industry should be subject to mandatory reductions year after year until we get to what is scientifically proven to be carbon emissions. Well, we think it should be zero. So we think we can get there. The cap is great. It's the trade part that we think completely... It both leaves out opportunities for low-income communities to clean air quality in their neighborhoods, and it also is an ineffective way to actually achieve those reductions.
Explain what the trade part is for folks who aren't familiar with that.
So I think the best thing to do is just use an example. So where some of the places where we organize are like Richmond, California, next to the Chevron refinery, one of the state's largest industrial polluters. So Chevron is one of the participants in the current cap and trade system. What it allows Chevron to do as one of the state's biggest polluters is to say, in order for us to get to the cap, the reduction that we're supposed to get to, we can in fact offset our we can say, we're going to keep polluting in this neighborhood as much as we want. What we'll do is we'll offset our pollution to another place. So that could be inside the state. They'll say they're going to buy an offset from a forest producer somewhere in California. Or they could say we're going to pay indigenous communities in another, in Chiapas, to have a forest on their land or something that supposedly that way that forest is taking carbon out of the air offsets the pollution that they're producing in Richmond in the neighborhood. So it's not, so there's no actual reductions on Chevron's behalf. It means that they can continue to pollute as much as they want, as long as they can pay for the offsets, which end up being an easier investment for them to make in terms of offsets or trading their right to pollute than making the actual reductions.
So if we stipulate that, like, some of the offsets are kind of fraudulent, which is not all of them, but has been well documented in
Absolutely.
Some cases. I think defenders of cap and trade would still say, look, the cap is still raising the cost to Chevron of polluting. As the cap gets lower, the cost of continuing to pollute is going to get higher. That is going to drive them to find a way to cut their emissions eventually.
I think that would be that's what it looks like on paper. What it also looks like on paper is that the number of offsets available are such that the price will not be that indicator for them that they need to reduce, that it's more cost effective for them. That market indicator doesn't exist right now. I think what you said in the very beginning, which is like speculating on whether or not these offsets are actually real, I think that is actually something that we can't gloss over either. The fact that these actual we all want to, wherever you sit in the environmental movement, wherever you sit, as a citizen, resident, a human being on the planet, you want the carbon reductions to work. You want these actual emissions to be put in place that are real. So we all have an interest in making sure that emission reductions are actually real emission reductions. Communities of color, low-income communities who live near these facilities have an even greater stake in that. And to say that to say to someone who grows up next to the Chevron refinery that it's okay for Chevron to continue to emit as much as it can pay for is patently unfair, wrong, and unjust.
And isn't the problem also that these communities are also being pit against each other, right? So if you're saying we're going to pollute more in Richmond, but we're going to, in the example that you had given, support Chiapas and growing forest growth, are you then seeing, problems emerge between impacted communities who would otherwise be more likely to come together in asking for change and then now are pit against each other in some ways?
I think folk communities in these market mechanisms are always pitted against each other. But I will say that there might be some examples where there have been folks in indigenous communities who are saying or have been, I guess, led to believe that these are the best ways for their communities to get out of poverty. And so I think, again, on paper, you can say we're pitted against each other. But what we're finding is more and more of these communities who have been part of some of these initial programs are not happy. They don't want, they didn't realize in what they're giving up in terms of their sovereignty on their land and their ability to control their own sovereign territory. And so I think that, yes, it does end up pitting interests, but in effect, this is part of what our movement is doing, is bringing together folks from impacted communities on both sides and, being able to support each other's kind of core common interests, and that is to get polluters to stop mining in our neighborhoods, to stop refining next to our schools, and to stop the climate crisis.
Speaking of Miyosh Itani, she is executive director of the Asian Pacific Environmental Network, one of the broad coalition of environmental justice groups that has been organizing demonstrations outside of the upcoming Global Climate Action Summit in San Francisco, demanding more aggressive climate action from the state of California. What's the alternative to cap and trade? It's not the only climate action the state's taking. It is the one it's applied to these large industrial polluters. But if that were not the regime that California was using to nominally reduce emissions from facilities like Chevron, what would California be doing?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because California actually has a huge range of programs that are reducing carbon emissions. And it's not just cap and trade is the format for industrial polluters. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of, so let's start with that. The alternative to cap and trade would just be emission reductions. It would be a regulatory regime that was mandated by the state and then was carried through by our state agencies and by regional agencies like the Bay Area Air Quality Management District. That's what they're set up for. They manage regulatory concerns with all kinds of pollutants. Carbon should be one of them that they're allowed to regulate.
Right. But I think, carbon dioxide is an unavoidable byproduct of burning fossil fuels. Like if we had someone from the refinery sector here, they would say, if you created a hard mandate to reduce carbon dioxide pollutions, we would have gas shortages in California the next week.
Well, of course, that's what they would say. And that's what they've said all along. And we have managed to historically make all kinds of regulatory approaches on all kinds of pollutants. Industry will always say, if you regulate us, you're going to have an impact on the consumer. And that has proven time and time again to be not true. I also don't want to gloss over the fact that a massive sudden reduction in oil production wouldn't have, I know that would have a an effect on prices, and that low-income communities would be most impacted by that. That's not even what we're talking about, though. So I feel like that's a little bit of a red herring to kind of say something that would be it's just not going to happen. That massive reduction is not going to happen. And there are ways that we've been talking about how do we protect consumers. I think you can look at exactly what another part of the sector is doing right now with the fires. So PG&E was just given sort of legislative leave, basically, of its responsibility in last year's fires that devastated Santa Rosa, as well as the rest of Northern California, and the impact on that is going to be a huge increase on ratepayers. That was done by the state, the legislature, signed by the governor. That was a direct result of climate. You know, the fires are a direct result of a changing climate in California. The governor has said it himself. And instead of protecting consumers and ratepayers, what he allowed to do was allowed an investor-owned utility to protect its profits to its shareholders and pass that cost on to electricity users.
Well, and let's go back to this issue of, you know, the cost to consumers, because this is very important for low-income communities. If we don't have the appropriate public transportation systems in place, the cost of rising gas prices is a serious concern. But the gas price issue has also been an extreme red herring, and it's looking at the state of California as if it's some sort of isolated bubble. And in fact, if you look at, which I have, production of oil in California, which has been on a decline for 30 years, that decline has been consistent and persistent. But the price of gasoline in the state has not risen in tandem with the production of oil production in the state. In fact, the price of gasoline in the state of California is exactly the same as the price of gasoline across the entire country. Mm-hmm. It moves with the global price of oil. And oil production in the state of California is not a siphon that goes directly into our gas tanks. It's a global marketplace. And the state oil companies have figured out a way to find the right gas price for them, mm-hmm. regardless of what they're doing with production, which has been on decline. So this idea of the continued managed decline of oil production in the state of California is what's being asked for. And what Governor Brown has said in response is, oh, that's going to send gas prices through the roof. There's just no evidence to support that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's part of what is challenging about talking about oil prices. And it's a common wedge that's used against us, is that jobs versus the environment, any kind of regulatory approach that you put on any emission or of trying to, you know, stop toxics in our neighborhood in any way is always seen as that is the thing that's used. And also the cynical part of it is they use people of color who have the most to gain out of this as the kind of all of a sudden oil companies really care about, you know, people living in poverty and the effect of oil prices on them. But it's true. It's California is part of a global oil market. What the prices that we pay are not set inside the borders of California only. They're set by what the overall supply is.
And so the ask of Governor Brown, can you talk more about the communities where production in the state is taking place and those communities that are making this call for the shift to stop new oil leases?
Well, yes. So when we look at where the most oil production is happening in the state, oil fracking is happening in Kern County, so in Central Valley. So those communities who, in some of those communities, they don't even have access to clean water. They don't have to a municipal clean water system. And yet these are the places where we are extracting some of the most oil out of the state. And in neighborhoods like South LA, you know, where you can walk outside your door and literally see oil wells pumping. I think people in Northern California who haven't actually seen this are somewhat surprised to like walk next to a school and see an oil rig. And these communities, as I said before, they have the most to gain by the reduction of these of the production of oil in the state of California. So I've been talking about refinery communities. These communities also have the most to gain in terms of emission reductions. But there is a very sensible way that we can go about reducing the gradually reducing a managed decline, a reduction of this production. We need to stop permitting new projects immediately. And it's these communities who have been most impacted by the industrial production of fossil fuels in the state are also your last guest was talking about the impacts of hurricanes, of extreme weather. When you have oil producing, oil refining, extractive industry in your neighborhood, climate change is a threat multiplier to you. So the drought that we're experiencing in California, the fires, any other kind of climate-related natural disaster, the communities who are already living next to these facilities are the ones who are going to be hurt the hardest. And so this all it's all connected. And that's why communities like the ones in Kern County are standing up, or in Arvin, who just passed the tiny town of Arvin, able to say that they stand up and say they don't want any more permitting of they want setbacks, they want these facilities to be further away from their kids, where their kids are playing and going to school, and that it's these communities that are starting to stand up and actually kind of take political power to be able to be in the front lines of this managed decline. They're doing that for all of us. they're helping build, shape policy for California the way that it should be, and the way that actually really reduces emissions in California, the way that's going to bring both the air quality benefits that we need and the actual emissions in the air that are causing the climate crisis.
So this is a relatively recent turn in the climate action movement. The focus on keeping fossil fuels in the ground rather than addressing them at the point where they're burned and consumed. Mm. And I was wondering if you could walk us through the logic of the argument, because the devil's advocate position would be, if you haven't addressed the demand, then shutting down wells in Kern County, which would be great for people living in Kern County, just means the oil industry is going to follow the path of least resistance and suck more out of, I don't know, the Ecuadorian Amazon.
It's actually something that a refrain that I've heard from Jerry Brown often is that, like, well, as soon as people in California stop driving, then we can deal with oil production. Actually, none of that is true. what we found that when you are reducing production, that you are actually addressing, on a numerical level, there's no possible way that we can drill all the oil that is out there on the earth. Like, if we are making available every possible source of fossil fuel, forever, we know what's going to happen. That I don't need to kind of give the
planet gets cooked.
Yeah, exactly. And so there is no alternative other than stopping the production of fossil fuels. We just cannot continue. And the impact of that, to borrow a term, should be offset by the massive investment in clean, renewable energy in all places. The arguments that we get in about impacts on consumers, it's not as if we don't have an alternative right now. We do have an alternative right now that's getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and is actually at this point right now, like, solar energy as the cheapest historically, and everyone, like, even 5 years ago, no one thought that we would be in this point where we would be looking at competitive pricing for renewable energy. That's one of the reasons that the governor's able to sign in SB 100 into law with a straight face. Things that we were saying 15 years ago, we can get to 100% clean energy. Everyone was saying that's not possible. It's just not possible in the economy. And now we know that that's not true.
And it's also very much not either or, but rather all of the above.
And I think we're going to have to leave it there.
Yeah.
Mia Yoshitani, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Mia Yoshitani is executive director with the Asian Pacific Environmental Network, one of the many organizations in the streets of San Francisco all week, asking California to step up its climate game while California is asking the world to step up its own.